Hi, and welcome back to the Business of Healthcare podcast. I'm your host, Tara Humphrey. I run an award-winning healthcare consultancy specialising in supporting primary care networks. I'm a facilitator. I am a mum of three. I have an MBA, and I would class myself as a bit of an adventurer. And I absolutely love all things business, all things leadership, all things management. So I created this podcast for clinical and non-clinical colleagues working in the field of health and care, and for those of you looking to develop your leadership skills. Every week we release an episode which focuses on the hard and soft skills required to lead in this increasingly complex environment as we move to delivering more integrated care. So let's jump into this week's episode. So in this week's episode, we've got something a little bit different. I am really, really pleased and proud to share that we've reached 300 episodes of the Business of Healthcare podcast, and THC Primary Care, my business, also celebrates 9 years in business. So I'm feeling really good. And I put on Instagram, should I do a solo episode to celebrate my achievement? It sounds very big-headed, but how should I celebrate? Should I do a solo interview on the podcast, or should I be interviewed? And I don't know why, but really surprisingly, loads of people said you should be interviewed, and James Somery should interview you, who is the co-founder, CEO of Somex. And he's also the host of the Health Tech Podcast and the editor of Health Tech Pigeon. So, James, thank you so, so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Delighted to be here. And similar to you, a little bit surprised to be here. I wouldn't have assumed that our audiences had that much crossover. But then again, there aren't that many podcasts in health, tech, care, etc., I guess. And we share a few guests, like, you know, like Mohammed from Patients Know Best and things like that. Like, we've had a few guests that have crossed over. So it's nice. A combination of a couple of people's universes, perhaps, on this one. So yeah, it should be fun.
So in this episode, I'm going to hand over the mic, which I really don't like to be interviewed, but handing over to James to interview me. Over to you, James.
Thank you very much. What an honor. What an honor. Long time listener, not necessarily first time caller. I've been on before, but second time caller. But yeah, no, it's great. I think your podcast is really great. And it's a really kind of honest look into lots of different parts of healthcare and leadership. And you get very sort of authentic stories from people. And so I'm looking forward to getting that from you and giving your listeners a chance to hear a little bit more about you than they perhaps might not normally. So we'll see how it goes. 300 episodes of a podcast, not very many people at all get to that level. You should be really proud. And I know you and I have had multiple conversations on this, that it isn't easy getting to 300 episodes. There are times where you have, I think Musty from Big Picture Medicine calls it the dip, where creators ride the initial wave of all their friends listening, all of their family listening, all of everybody listening. Then all of a sudden everyone stops listening. It starts to get a little bit more difficult and you're riding off your own motivation. I know you and I have had that before, but our podcasts have delivered so much for us. They've delivered us network, they've delivered us lots of different things. But I'm interested in your perspective. In 300 episodes, what do you feel like the podcast has given you? What have you learned? Talk to me about that.
So I am based in Whitstable in Kent in the southeast, and the podcast has just given me reach. It's given me exposure to people that would never need to speak to me if I didn't have a podcast. And I find it quite remarkable. I can go to a conference and people recognize my voice. It's surreal. It's just enabled me to go from working in my office in Whitstable to working all over the country, which is crazy. And it's given me a phenomenal network. But I don't really know how to use my network. I always think this. I always think, if I need anything, I could just call somebody, but I very rarely do. But I have got a fantastic, fantastic network. And I suppose it has given me confidence. I really do enjoy meeting people and talking to people one-on-one, and I really just appreciate their time. And I think it's helped me just get better at asking fundamental questions. And I think we're so busy and just saying, but why? Why do you think that? Why do you believe that? Or share a challenge. And I think it's just a lovely way to communicate with people.
I think that's testament to your curiosity, though, as well, because the best way I've heard it described in terms of advice, and this is advice that I turn around to newer podcasters now, is just ask questions that you genuinely want to know the answers to. And I think that's the thing. You can't hide your actual personality behind 300 hours of content online. And when you are a genuinely curious person who does care about the person on the other side, wants to genuinely learn from them, that obviously comes across, and it certainly comes across in your episodes. So yeah, I think that's really nice. Do you have any standout moments that come to mind when you think about 300 episodes? Can you remember your first episode, for example? And do you have any kind of peaks of your curiosity, etc., being fulfilled in the 300 episodes after the first one?
I don't know if it was my first, but I interviewed Gary Hughes, and now he's like still my friend, and we do some work together. So me reaching out to Gary, he was at the time very active on LinkedIn, and reaching out to him was like so scary, and we're still friends now. So that was really, really nice. My standout episode is very personal to me. I can't remember the number. It's when Seddy Frederick came on to the podcast, and he at the time was chair of a hospital trust, and he was one of 10 ethnic minority leaders. And he came onto the podcast, and it sounds really silly. I feel like outside of my family, he was like the first person that just saw me, just got me. And I spoke to him like I just knew him forever. It was so strange and amazing. Like when I listen back to that podcast, it's not an emotional podcast, but it makes me feel emotional. So he's been on the podcast a couple of times, and we communicate sometimes. And I know we're all just people, and we all should just see each other as equal. But when you see people that you perceive as above you, and then they see you, it's like, oh my God. I know you shouldn't give people that kind of like power, but to me, he's just remarkable and just so incredible. And I really look up to him. So that was a fantastic moment for me. A guy called Partha Kaur came on the podcast, and he is the National Speciality Advisor for Type 1 Diabetes at NHS England. It's absolutely fantastic. And I don't prepare questions. I used to. And then I just stopped because it wasn't a good interview. And at the end of that interview, I was a bit like, you can do this. And to be honest, that was about 200 episodes in. But I was thinking, you're good at this. He's amazing. So that was really good. And I like my solo episodes. I vowed to be as honest as I can on the podcast. Like, I don't want to censor myself. Like, I've told people, like, when we've sacked a client, or a client has ended their contract early with us, or I've sacked somebody. I never, ever want the podcast or anything I do. I never want to be that person that's like, look at me, I'm amazing. Everything I do turns to gold. I'm perfect. I'm not, and it's not, and it's hard. I hope that when people especially listen to the solo episodes, I am telling you the truth, and there are ups and there are downs. And that is really important to me. And I like that I feel comfortable enough to be able to do that.
It's interesting that when he came on, you know, 200 episodes in, and you have the episode and you're like, I can actually do this. I can relate, by the way. I think that talks to the fact that podcasting, it's an interesting word to describe. I'm a podcaster. Someone saying like I'm a TikToker. You're sort of personified via the platform that you put out content. In reality, what you are is a skilled interviewer. It takes time to become a skilled interviewer. And actually, you know, 200 episodes in, part of being that skilled interviewer, I think, is actually becoming comfortable in your role when you are interviewing people that you look up to. I think being able to back your skill in your craft to a point where you are no longer nervous and then affected by that anxiety, it's an important milestone. It really is. And it does speak to the fact that you are a skilled interviewer. And actually, that does itself provide value. It provides value to you being able to do that and use that in whatever ways you want to, and panels and the rest of it, but actually to your audience as well. Because actually, by perfecting that craft and having a skilled interviewer interview these people, you can get to truth, which is also something that you clearly care about. I guess it's similar to journalism. Like, true journalist is in source of truth, and they're in source of truth for the benefit of the general public. And I think that's part of what we do. The other thing I want to talk about was relatability there is important to you. It's important to you to find truth. It's important to you to reflect truth of your own experience as well. Why is it important to you, do you think, that relatability is important? Is it because you're trying to role model? Is it because you think that helps people the most? Why is it that relatability is important to you?
I just want to be me. Before I had this business and I worked at a university, and for the most part of my university career, it was okay. I did enjoy it. I got to do some amazing things. But towards the end, I left a little bit under a cloud and I was so upset. And I remember writing in my journal, like, I just want to work in a place where, like, I can be me. I feel respected. I just kept writing, I just want to be me. I just want to be me. I don't want to feel like I'm pretending, I'm putting anything on, I'm blending in. I just want to be me. So I think that's where it comes from. I think if you listen to the podcast and then you meet me, I'd be really upset if somebody was a bit like, well, she's not like how she is. She's different online or she's different on the podcast. It would make me feel sad because I just want people to know to a degree, and that is important, what you see is what you get. And when I say to a degree, Sophie, who's my podcast manager, said to me, Tara, you share a lot and you also share nothing. And I thought that was really interesting. I don't share everything. I don't need to share everything. It's my work. It's not my life. It's a professional podcast. But I want people to get a sense of who I am, what's important to me. And I just want to just be me. And I think for me, when people only share the good stuff, and I don't want to be negative, I don't want to fill my little corner up of the internet with negativity, but it's not all happy roses dancing all of the time. It's not. And I just think it would be inauthentic to be like a primary care professional, just go, life is great all of the time. People would be thinking, no, it's not.
It would also take a lot of energy of you. I can point to the points in my life where I think I've been the lowest. Those are the moments where, like, the way I was living my life was inauthentic. It was not reflective of who I actually am. I completely and utterly relate to that. So yes, in part, it's of course, you want others to perceive you in a certain way. But I think, like you were talking about, I just want to be me. That frustration, that energy that's expended by being in a life that's inauthentic is, well, first of all, I think it's difficult to recognize. So kudos for recognizing that in yourself. I think that requires a lot of self-awareness to know what you like doing, and to listen to yourself. I think that's really hard. And then to take action to make it happen, I think is incredible. And so to actually get to a point where you are now, where you can live authentically, is really interesting to me. So how did you get to a point where you had the skills, the knowledge, and the confidence to run your own business? What does that journey look like for you?
So, long story short, I used to work at a university in the Faculty of Health and the Faculty of Education. And one of my projects was working with some GPs. I'd been given some money from NHS England. And because we're in the Faculty of Health, we gave them premises. And my job was to help commercialize academic ideas and create partnerships. And my kind of like a mentor said to me, Tara, come along to this meeting. There's some GPs. And it was at like 7 or 8 o'clock at night. And I was thinking, I don't want to do that. I finished work at 5. And he said, come on, just come on. And I was like, okay. That changed my life. That meeting changed my life. I remember going in, Maya Vibhuti was there, who I'm working with in a couple of weeks, Dr. Nathan, Dr. Sati Lau, and Dr. Tariq Hussein was in this meeting. All diverse. Peter was the only white person in that room. And they were, in my mind, really young, dynamic people. And I was just thinking, you're doctors and you're young and you're nice and you're funny and you're entrepreneurial. I always say to people, I would walk past a general practice surgery every day and never think I could work there. It was not ever on my radar. And then they'd been given some money to support education in primary care. And I was going to write their operating plan. So we were working together. And then when I was looking to leave the university, I said to them, I'm leaving. And they said, who's going to finish our operating plan? And I said, well, I can, but can you pay me? Because I'm not going to have a job. And they said, oh, you setting up your own business? And I went, yeah. Honestly, I had no desire. My sister runs a business. And I used to think, you were crazy. I never, ever aspired to run. I wanted to be a CEO. I definitely wanted to be a CEO. And I thought I would just manifest being CEO for NHS England. I never, ever thought I would set up my own business. And literally that day, and it was on my birthday on the 17th of March, I went home and I Googled how to set up a business. And I messaged my sister And I said, I'm setting up a business. What should I call it? And she went, it makes her sound really unsupportive in this moment. She's not. She went, oh, just call it your name. If it's good enough for Calvin Klein, it can be good enough for you. So I just called it Tara Humphrey Consulting. That was in March. In October, I had a virtual assistant. I went from Medway CPN to East Kent CPN to West Kent. And then I called a lady called Melanie and said, you're a CPN manager. It was to stand for Community Education Provider Network Manager. I'm doing something similar. What do you do? What do you do? Like, it's not do my job. And she and she said to me, come to London, come to Richmond. And I met her in India Peach. And it's really important for me to say these names. I met Melanie Ashdown, I met India Peach, and we sat on Richmond Park. And I was a little bit like, do we need to go now? And she was like, Tara, slow down. Primary care moves at a different pace. Slow down. And so going back to where did I find the confidence? I'm still trying to find it. And I think I just do it. I do it and then go, oh, I've done it. It was very right place, right time. And my husband was really supportive. And I said to him, I think I'm going to set up my own business. And then I said, what if I don't get any clients? And he went, you will. And I went, but what if I don't? And he went, you will. And I was like, babe, this isn't helpful. And he was like, but you will. And literally that was it. So the people around me that love me are that's really so nice. Quite, my sister's like, do this. My husband's like, don't worry about it. Yeah. So I'm just like, okay.
So you didn't worry and here you are. What a beautiful story. It's a quite a sliding doors moment, isn't it? Like, what if you hadn't have gone to that meeting? What do you think you'd be doing if you weren't doing this? Let's say either you hadn't have gone to that meeting, what route would you have pursued? Or indeed, play out your interests and all the rest of it. Where do you think you would be if you weren't doing this? What would you be doing?
Do you know what? I would have just gone to the University of Kent, which is the other university down the road, and I'd be doing the exact same job and hating it. Like, honestly, I would have just got the same job in a different institution and probably would have stayed there really frustrated. But I definitely would have pursued just working in universities because I didn't know any different, really. I did have private sector experience, but I probably would have stayed in that route.
I think you would have had, I think your entrepreneurial nature would have caught up with you, in all honesty. I don't think there's any escaping it of people. I see it quite often. You know, you can't keep an entrepreneur down. Like, you can't. And actually, I think that nature, even actually when you mentioned that you were commercializing academia, that in itself requires an entrepreneurial part of you to even be able to do that or gravitating towards that in some way. That sounds very my world. That sounds very health tech. That sounds very tech transfer, you know, commercializing academia. Technology is obviously one way of doing it, and there's plenty of ways of doing it. But I would perhaps suggest that you are entrepreneurial and the forces of nature were dragging you towards that world. No?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, in that job, so people would bring me their ideas and I would kind of go, oh my God, I'd go, no, that's not
the Julius Caesar thumbs up, thumbs down. Yeah.
Like, who the hell was I to be able to say, I think this is a goer? Like, which is ridiculous when I think about it now. One of the things we tried to do, but we didn't, but this was amazing. We tried to bring a children's nursery on campus and like, what would that look like? So my business planning skills really came into play. Built a stem cell laboratory. That was an amazing project. Took me to India. I was working with a new local private hospital. When I met the GPs, when I started developing the stem cell laboratory, that was like, healthcare is where I want to be. I did start to think that. So that was an amazing project and that actually got built. We looked at like, could you commercialize stem cells? Could the hospital buy them and all of the ethics and things around that? We also did some international courses around minimally invasive surgery. So bringing in sponsors for that. And I worked with a guy called Professor Anand Shetty, who kind of in hindsight really helped my networking skills. Like business development, he didn't pay for anything, nothing. He got everything via the sponsors, but treated the sponsors so well, you know, like it was worth it for them. So I think, yeah, you kind of only look back and you think, oh, wow, that's where I got all of those skills.
Yeah. You do seem very aware of sort of what you can learn from everyone along your journey. I think that ability to kind of critically appraise who you're around and the good parts of their nature that you can add to your own bow, those strings that you can add to your bow. I think that's a wonderful way to build a career, especially then being able to go into your own business. You've got to pick this stuff up where you can, especially if you're not surrounded by entrepreneurs. You're not like a founder's associate somewhere where it's a lot more obvious. You've got to pick this up where you can. So I think that's great. One thing that you mentioned recently and talked about with some of your content was your pride of being a Black female leader. I mean, you said in primary care, which I think was actually, you know, you are a Black female leader in healthcare and one of the stronger voices and bigger voices in healthcare, I think more broadly, I think it's fair to say, with the people that you bring onto your podcast and the personal brand that you've grown for yourself. And it's interesting because like I connect with that pride in a small way in that my dad was a Black male, I guess, leader in healthcare to an extent. He was born in the 40s. So, you know, 60s, 70s, 80s was when he was a nurse. And he then sort of rose the ranks to what would now be a kind of regional chief nursing officer. So very much on that side of the world. And when I hear some of the stories and think back to what life must have been like then, it must have been interesting and challenging and difficult in lots of ways. But I know that the level that he got to, he was very proud of. And I like thinking about that. And when I see you talking about your pride of being Black and female and a leader and in primary care, it brought a lot of that up for me, which was quite nice because I could think about it and connect with it again in an authentic way and gave me the opportunity to reflect on that and looked at some old photos and stuff like that. So that was really nice. So first of all, thank you for giving me that and those few moments. But I want to talk to you about that pride. And I want you to sort of explain that pride a little bit. And perhaps why you're proud. And I guess more broadly, how you feel about representation in healthcare off the back of that.
So I live in a predominantly white area. And going back to I just want to be me, the university was all white. And I think for a long time, and I'm really like I'm super tall. And it, which is really hard to blend in. You're Black, you're really tall, and you live in a white area.
Yeah, you've got to lean in at that point, haven't you? You can't slink into the background.
Yeah. And my parents were white, so I was fostered with my sister. So I think subconsciously, it was just conditioned. I just want to blend in. I used to have super straight hair and just try to blend in. It's interesting that you pick that up. I didn't even realize I really said it, if that makes sense. I think it's taken me nearly 9 years, well, like, how old am I? 42, like 41 years to feel proud. And I think my conversations with Sedi, like I would never have said that in the beginning. And at one point I didn't want my face on the business. I used to be scared that if people could see that I was Black straight away, they wouldn't want to work with me. I feel like ashamed to say that, but that's what I used to think. I used to think people will not want to work with me because I'm Black. They will think that I'm not very good or whatever. And I think now I just think this is me. Like I can't, like I am Black and I wouldn't want to be anything else. Like this is just me. And I think for the business hat on, and there's this book called The Unfair Advantage. It's like, Tara, what are your unfair advantages and use them. You are one of the few Black leaders in healthcare that has got a podcast that has reached 300 episodes. And that podcast enables me to work all across the country, to host panels, to be part of conferences. I should be proud of that. This is me. And I should embrace it because why wouldn't I? And it's taken me a long time because I used to hold the thought, just pick me because I'm good at my job. Just want to be good at my job. I don't want to be Black Tara or like, oh, we need a Black person. Maybe we can ask Tara. And I do want that. I want people to think she's good at her job. That's why we want her. But we don't live in that world. And some people will say, look at the panel. We don't have any diversity here. Do you know anybody? Do you know anybody that's not white? And I've got an extensive portfolio. Why would you not ask me? You want the diversity and you want the expertise. There are people out there and it makes it easier for me to push myself to the front because I've got the blog, I've got the podcast, because I put myself out there and I should embrace that versus hide and expect people to find me.
Absolutely. And you're right. Part of being authentic is actually acknowledging the authenticity of the world around you as well. And actually to critically appraise that and be like, okay, yeah, this is the world that I'm in. I might have been asked for these reasons, but there's nothing stopping me going there. and being the best speaker there and actually showing them this and changing hearts and minds, et cetera, et cetera. Like, there is something there for me. I don't know, we don't want to turn the podcast into this entirely, but like, at times, I imagine you didn't ask to be this. You didn't ask to be role modeling for this. You didn't ask to be looked at in this way and all those things. And sometimes maybe you do want to actually slink into the background, and it's a privilege not afforded to you at times. But I think what you've done incredibly well is you found a way to become proud of yourself. That's wonderful, because actually you should be. You have achieved so much, not only the 300 episodes, the 9 years, but how good you are at your job. I think that's wonderful. And the fact that you are held up as someone that people can look up to, whether you like it or not, and I say that with love, you are someone that is role modeled. And I think that's a wonderful thing. I'm interested in where this all leads for you. So is there an end goal? Are you someone that has a destination here for everything that you're doing? Do you have a kind of final goal? Are you someone that just wants to optimize for now and enjoying your life? You do manage to juggle a lot. You're very active physically. You do a lot of sport. You have a family. You have your business. You have a lot going on. There's a lot to your life that you live very full from what we can all see with your content. How do you define happiness, contentment, and or success?
Two parts to that question. So I think the end goal, I don't really want to share it, but I do have an end in mind. It's not an end goal, but one of the things I'd love to do was, I would like to write a book. I've said this to you before. I would really like to write a modern management healthcare book. I can see the book launch in Augustine House, my old university. There's a beautiful glass library. And I want that book to be, you know, like you've got like all of the management books that are just tried and tested, and they work, their content is there. But I want the kind of MBA lecturers and public sector lecturers to say, you need to buy this book. It's a modern take on healthcare. This is what your life is going to look like in this job. This is what you can expect. So I would love, 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 love to do that. And I will do that. So I see books in my future, still want the business, but the business will definitely pivot. And I would like multiple businesses. Hopefully this is not my first and only. I definitely would like a portfolio, or to be like a non-executive director in other businesses. I would love to be able to have that opportunity. And my primary care colleagues will maybe be surprised at this. I'd love to be a partner in a practice.
Wow.
A general practice. I would absolutely love that opportunity to be able to say, because I've never worked in general practice. I love it. Love, 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 love it. But I've never been in it, you know, like in the core of it. And I think that I would love to be able to be in it. So definitely, yeah, portfolio of businesses and some books.
You heard it here first. They'll be queuing up, Tara. Honestly, they'll be queuing up. Just out of interest, the book, talk about modern management. What comes to mind when you're thinking like, okay, the content of this book, like chapters here? And I suppose like what I'm getting at is you've got a normal management book that will say very normal things. That's a very sort of academic management or whatever, or, you know, that side of the world. What would your information be? How would your information be different? What are the chapters you've got in mind here?
Okay, we're just brainstorming right now. So I don't have an outline in my, I've not written the outline, but I've read a paper called We're All Boundary Spanners Now. And I am rewriting that as a modern take, because it was very dry. It was very academic. People said they couldn't relate to it. So just the relator, it's a relatable book. It's like, I use the term like in primary care, it's probably like in all sectors. You heard the term herding cats. It's not like herding cats. It's like herding tigers. So one chapter would be, is herding tigers. And that is a name of a book elsewhere. So I will reference the author. But in primary care, it's like, if you try to move somebody that does not want to be moved, like watch your back, even the quietest of practices will make it known, back the F off. It can be ferocious. They really, really, really are. So the nature of relationships and the negotiation and the time it takes to make a decision across multiple stakeholders. And when you think you've made the decision, then, you know, a look, a side eye, it's not a business deal, but they can throw that deal off the table. So helping people to understand, you know, like observe it. Because sometimes managers come into primary care network management roles, they think it's them. And it's like, observe your environment, look at the politics, look at the dynamics. It's very hierarchical, and it's also not. There are some people, even that they perceive at the bottom of the chain, are very influential. And when you can start to kind of navigate around that, you're like, oh, okay, you start to build the momentum. And another chapter would be, and I need to make this not sound dry, but it would be around complexity theory. You change one thing in one area, all happy days, but because you don't understand the system, you've had a negative impact in another part of the system because you're only focused on your own bit. But if you want to be a system leader, you need to understand the bigger picture. Some things you'll never know what the unintended consequence is going to be. But sometimes actually, if you just took a bit more time and you spoke to people, you would know actually, if I stop sending this letter or stop sending that message or do something different, then that stops the signal to another part of the system. Things like that.
I think that's great. What came to mind for me there is just, this is why you have a consultancy in this stuff. And this is why you're so good at your job, because you've neatly explained just in that small vignette, the IQ and the EQ necessary for modern leadership is extensive. Add to that the experience required to understand how things change. Change one thing, you change many. Unintended consequences, all these different things. You don't amass the knowledge of that complexity overnight. You can't get the management consultants in that are generalist to come and tell you what to do, which is why your business being so niched, I think, is really interesting to me. And that's what I wanted to ask you next, which is, do you face any pressure to kind of expand beyond the boundaries that you have? The business that you have, obviously, is a niched consultancy into niched primary care. And the market size is only so, or the market size is so, or you might be a market maker in people see what you do and didn't think before they needed your help. Now they know that they can benefit from it. And perhaps that's part of the answer that you can market make. But I imagine at the same time, like, you and I both run bootstrapped sort of consultancy style businesses, and I imagine you might get the amount of unsolicited advice that I often get from friends and family and all the rest of it, that I'm sure people are like, why don't you have other clients? Why don't you do other stuff? Why not secondary care? You can triple your market size, like whatever. I mean, do you face pressure to increase what you do? Do you like the fact you're niche? Are you always going to stay niche? How do you think about that niche focus and how expert you've perhaps become?
I don't feel external pressure, but I'm opening myself up. So I think it was last week we secured a client, health tech client, that wants to understand primary care networks and understand how the money flows and understand the decision making and understand like how we like to buy and sell. And I think that in the past, I was like, no, we don't do that. We don't do that. We only work for primary care networks. I could help other businesses. So I'm so looking forward to that. I think it's going to be excellent. And I've brought in a clinical director. So that's something that we could do. And I think that bringing together expert panels, going back to my network, I think if you want, and I've done this in slightly different capacities, but I do think I could do that myself. If you've got an idea, rather than just, you know, like launch it into darkness, just come to the people. Like it's like Dragon's Den and just pick our brains. Because we are the people that are not just me, you know, like primary care operates in a way that actually a few people can make a really big difference if you get them at the right time. So I definitely think we could do more in the private space. I love primary care networks. And I suppose I think about my clients and I think, how would they feel if then Tara was helping them to work with me? So that's why we've not really done it, because I feel, I don't know, like cheating on them. I don't know. But I think that's me thinking too small. I couldn't see myself working in secondary care. I really couldn't. But I like being niche. I don't believe primary care and, you know, general practice is going anywhere. And I think that as we work more collaboratively, more together, hopefully organizations see THC primary carers. They can help us understand primary care. They can help us weave together, because primary care is a first stop. So actually, if you want an integrated neighborhood team, which spans, I always take the example of diabetes because I know it the most. It's actually, you've got first diagnosis, you've got secondary care, you have got the health tech, you've got the patient peer groups and advocacy, might have the dietitian, opticians involved. There's so many people involved. You've got parents, you've got families, the education and all of the training. That at the moment is very disjointed. But actually, if you look at the patient, it's one pathway. It could be one pathway. And I think PATH has helped educate me on this, you know, like this artificial divide, like when you're from children to adult, actually, could it be done differently? And actually, people like myself who have got lived experience and understand primary care and a little bit of what happens in secondary care from a carer's perspective can help join the dots for that.
Amazing. You talk about diabetes, you talk about health tech there and your personal lived experience. Obviously, as the parent of a child with diabetes, I can't let you go without getting health tech in some way, given that it's me. But I'm interested, though, in your just in your personal relationship with health tech, your personal experience of health tech through that lens. I guess the patient side, the parent of a patient side. What's your relationship with health tech?
I feel like I'm going to cry. It's changed Talia's life. And wow. In that, it's changed all of our lives. And I think,
wow.
I think that what I've learned is, and you will obviously know this better than me, but I can't think of the right kind of terminology. There is levels of health tech and you've got apps that are like, yes, you get the information in your pocket and that's great. And then there's health tech, which changes your life. So Talia, she's type 1 diabetic. She cannot produce her own insulin. So she wears an Omnipod pod on her arm, which delivers continuous glucose to her 24 hours a day. And it's hybrid closed loop. So it talks to another transmitter, which helps her constantly titrate her levels up and down, up and down, up and down to try to keep her steady. Now, Talia is 11. And the fact that she has that tech and we get it for free is just, I just will be forever grateful. And I would pay for it, but I don't have to. It has been transformative. We just feel so, so incredibly lucky. We use Omnipod for the insulin pod and we use Dexcom for the transmitter, which monitors her blood glucose levels. And the fact that you've got hybrid closed loops, so those different organizations work together, you know, like to make it compatible. And I think that's the future where you've got huge organizations, they're complementary, don't get me wrong, huge organizations coming together to make this work. And then I went to an event, I think it was in Milton Keynes, where all of the providers were there and it was really nice. And they all did their like Dragon's Den pitch, but it was like a sort of environment. Yes, it's competitive because they're private organizations, but also they want to do good. We can choose and we've got the choice. It was just fantastic having clinicians, private sector, charity, schools. It's amazing. And I think health tech with a personal touch is the best. I think the health tech on its own, we couldn't do it on its own. If somebody just gave it to us, it would not be as good as me being able to phone up the customer service or having, you know, like education or having YouTube and people going, this is how I've done it. And these are the hacks to like keep it on when you're swimming. All of that stuff. You do need people. It wouldn't be the same, just the tech on its own.
I absolutely love that. There's such a beauty to what you've just talked about. The fact that those organizations can come together. You said come together to make something work. And there's something fundamentally human, I think, that chokes me up quite often when you see humans coming together to make something work. Like, it fascinates me that there's something about, we're privileged in healthcare, right? Because in healthcare, ultimately, we're all pulling in the same direction here. We all want the same things. We're not in politics where, you know, we want fundamentally different things, or I suppose fundamentally the same thing, but in two very different ways, or multiple very different ways. We're in healthcare where we all kind of want the same thing in roughly the same way. It's just, we're going to try and help each other to become better. And yeah, when you see people come together to make things work, I think there is a beauty to that. And I think on that note, to wrap things up, thank you for your podcast that does exactly the same thing. It brings people together to make things work. There will be people that listen to your podcast that get in touch with the guests. There'll be guests that come on that connect with other guests. There'll be people that meet in the real world that talk about a shared love of your podcast that then manage to connect together to go and do things. And I think the way that you go about things, the brand and the authenticity that you're willing to bring echoes into those relationships, because that's what you want. You're creating the world that you want to live in. And I think that's a great thing. You're so authentic in the way that you do that. And I look forward to seeing your content. The amount of times that I've done a workout that I was never going to do because I'm scrolling Instagram and, and you're there, you've already been up for 4 hours and you've like done a Peloton and you've been for a run and you're now walking to work. I'm like, oh my God, I need to get out and move myself. You're inspirational. It's great. It's wonderful. And you're a role model and you're all of those different things. I think it's awesome what you've achieved. Congratulations for getting to 300 episodes. Congratulations for getting to 9 years. I'm sure there'll be 300 more and 9 more years. So congratulations.
Thank you. So just to close that episode out, I hope that you found it interesting. And if you are a regular listener. I appreciate you so, so, so much. I always say you don't need to listen to every single one, but just keep us in your kind of top podcasts. And when you see a topic that you think is interesting, definitely check it out. Please share the podcast. It really does make a difference. And the podcast, we grow organically through people sharing it. So if you like it, please share it. Please leave a rating and review. Again, that helps push the podcast out to more people. And if it's the first time you have ever listened to the podcast, you've got some catching up to do. This is our 300th episode. We've got a mixture of solo podcasts and interviews covering the broad spectrum of healthcare. I hope you enjoy it, and I will see you in the next episode.